pause was brief now. Charles Sumner Alden said, "He owns an investigation concern in France, I believe."
"Correct.
He runs the largest international private detective firm there is, with offices all over the world. If Clark has left the U.S., then Fabrice Bertrand Morel's men will ferret him out."
"He sounds like he will be a suitable choice," Alden said.
Lasker replied, "It's 6 a.m. in France. If I call him now, I will reach him on his morning walk. I will arrange a late dinner for us this evening over there."
"Excellent.
Good night, Charles."
"Paul.
We need him alive. We understand that, right?"
"Good Lord. Why would you even entertain the thought that I might..."
"Because I know Bertrand Morel has hunted men down and killed them in the past."
"I have heard the allegations, but nothing has ever gone past the inquiry stage."
"Well, that is because he has been helpful to the nations where his crimes have been committed." Laska did not speak to this, so Alden rendered an explanation for his knowledge of this man and his company.
"I'm with the CIA. We know all about the work of Fabrice Bertrand Morel. He has a reputation as capable, but unscrupulous. And his men have a reputation around the CIA as cutthroats.
Now, please understand. I need absolute clarity between you and me that neither President Keelty nor anyone working with or for him is advocating that Mr. Clark be murdered."
"We have an accord."
"Good night, Charles," Laska said. Sam Driscoll found himself surprised and quite confused to see the sunrise. His guards did not communicate with him at all, so he never knew why Haqqani's people did not follow General Rian's order to interrogate him and then stand him up against the wall and shoot him. Luck is real, and once in a while, it is even good. Driscoll would never know, but the day before his capture in the Fatah, 25 miles north of his location in Miran Shah, three senior Haqqani network chiefs were picked up at a roadblock in Gorbaz, a small Afghani town just south of the Haqqani stronghold of Khost. For a few weeks, Haqqani and his men thought NATO forces were holding the men, and Siraj Haqqani himself, after learning of the fortuitous capture by his men of a Western spy, sent orders countermanding Rihan's wishes. The American would be held in trade for his men, and he was not to be harmed. It was not for another 2 months that the bodies of the three Haqqani network chiefs were found wrapped in burlap floor coverings and dumped in a garbage heap north of Khost. They were victims of a rival Taliban affiliate group. NATO had nothing to do with their capture or murder. But this bought Driscoll a little time. In the early morning after Rihan's visit, Driscoll's chains were freed from the eye bolt in the floor, and he was pulled to his feet. He wobbled on his injured legs. His head was covered in a traditional patu shawl, presumably to make him invisible to UAVs, and he was shuffled out of his cold cell, pushed into the dawn's light, and helped up into the back of a Toyota Hilux truck. He was driven north, out of the compound by the Banu Road Bridge, up Banu, and deeper into the city of Miran Shah. He heard truck engines and horns honking. At intersections he could hear men on foot as they walked the narrow streets, even so early in the morning. They cleared the town minutes later. Sam knew this by the increase in speed and the lack of noises from other vehicles. They drove for almost 2 hours. As far as Driscoll could tell, he was not in a convoy at all, just sitting in the back of a single pickup truck that cruised through open territory, seemingly without a care in the world. The men in the back with him, he had identified three distinct voices but felt sure there were more, laughed and joked with one another. They didn't seem to worry about American drones or Pakistani Defense Force ground troops. No, this was Haqqani territory. The men around Sam in the truck were in charge here. Finally, they rolled up the North Waziristan Road into the town of Azizkel and pulled into a large gated compound. Sam was hauled from the truck as it stopped and then frog-walked into a building. Here his head covering was removed and he found himself in a dark hallway. He was led down the hall. He passed rooms full of women in burqas who did their best to stay in the shadows. And he passed long-bearded armed Haqqani network gunmen at the top of a stone staircase that led down into a basement level. He stumbled more than once. The shrapnel wounds in his thighs and calves had caused muscle injuries that made walking uncoordinated as well as painful, and with the metal chains on his wrists, he could not reach out to balance himself. As he passed the locals here, he was somewhat surprised to see there was little interest in him from those around the compound. Either this place got a lot of prisoners, or they were just disciplined enough to not make a show of someone new in their midst. Down in the basement, he had his answer. He entered a room at the end of a stone hall, then passed a long row of small iron bar-fronted cells on his left. Looking into the dim cages, he counted 7 prisoners. One was Western, a young man who did not speak as Driscoll passed. 2 more were Asian. They lay on rope cots and stared blankly back at him. The rest of the prisoners were Afghans or Pakistanis. One of these men, a burly older man with a long gray beard, lay on the floor of his cell on his back. His eyes were half open and glassy. It was apparent, even in the low light, that his life would be leaving his body soon unless he received medical care. Driscoll's new home was the last cell on the left. It was dark and cold, but there was a rope cot that would keep him off the concrete floor, and the guards removed his chains. As the iron bars clanged shut behind him, he stepped over the waste bucket and eased his sore body onto the cot. For a former Army Ranger accustomed to living an austere life, these digs weren't the worst he'd ever seen. They were a damn sight better than where he'd just come from, and the fact that it looked like he might be here for a while it was certainly not his first choice, caused his spirits to improve markedly from where they had been a day before. But more than anything involving his own predicament, Sam Driscoll thought about his mission. He just had to find some way to get the word back to the campus that General Rian was working with Haqqani Network agents on something that he very much wanted to keep shrouded in secrecy. 48. Paul Laska would have very much liked to visit this beautiful 19th-century French estate in the summer. The swimming pool was exquisite. The beach below was private and pristine, and there was outdoor seating all over the back of the huge walled property. Ideal natural nooks in the gardens and grounds set for relaxing or dining or enjoying a cocktail as the sun set. But it was late October now, and though it was still quite lovely here out in the back garden, with afternoon temperatures hovering in the lower 60s and evenings dipping down into the upper 40s, there was not much in the way of outdoor recreation to be had for a 70-year-old man. The pool and the Mediterranean were both frigid. And, in any case, Laska did not have time for frivolity. He was on a mission. St. Agulf was a developed seaside town, without all the clutter and crowds of Saint-Tropez, just to the south on the southern tip of the Bay of Saint-Tropez. But it was as beautiful as its more famous neighbor. In fact, the exquisite villa, the hills behind it, and the water in front of it were, to put it mildly, paradise. The property was not his own. It belonged instead to an A-list Hollywood actor who split his time between the west coast of the United States and the southern coast of France. A call from Alaska aid to the actor's people had secured the villa for the week, though Paul expected to be here less than a day. It was well after 9 p.m. when a burly Frenchman in his mid-50s entered the back patio through the sliding glass doors from the library. He wore a blue blazer with the collar open to reveal his thick neck. He'd come up from Cannes, and he moved like a man who had someplace to be. Laska stood from his chair by the infinity pool when the man approached.
"How wonderful to see you again, Paul."
"Likewise, Fabrice. You are looking healthy and tan.
And you are looking like you are working too hard over there in America. I always tell you, come to the south of France, you will live forever.
May I fix you a cognac before dinner?"
"Merci."
Laska stepped over to a rolling cart near his table by the pool. As the two men discussed the beautiful villa and the beautiful girlfriend of the actor who owned it, the Czech billionaire poured cognac into a pair of brandy snifters and passed one to his guest. Fabrice Bertrand Morel took the snifter, sipped, and nodded in appreciation. Laska motioned for the Frenchman to take a seat at the table.
"You are always the gentleman, my dear Paul."
Laska nodded with a smile as he warmed the cup of the snifter with his hand. Then Bertrand Morel finished the thought.
"Which makes me wonder why you allow your bodyguards to search me for a wire. It was a little too intimate."
The older man shrugged.
"Israelis," he said, as if that somehow explained the frisking that had just taken place inside the house.
Bertrand Morel let it go. He held his snifter over the open flame of a tea-light candle on the table to warm it.
"So, Paul, I enjoy seeing you in person, even if it comes with demands to lift my shirt and to loosen my belt. It has been so very long. But I am wondering, what could possibly be so très important that we would need to meet like this?
Perhaps the matter can wait until after dinner."
"Let me hear it now. If it is important enough, then dinner can wait."
Laska smiled.
"Fabrice, I know you as a man who can assist in the most delicate of affairs."
"I am at your service, as always."
"I imagine you know of the John Clark matter that is on the news in the United States."
Laska inflected the statement as a question, but he had little doubt that the French investigator knew all about the matter.
"Oui, l'affaire Clark."
Jack Ryan's personal assassin, or so say the French papers. It is every bit as grave a scandal as that. I need you and your operatives to find Mr. Clark.
Fabrice Bertrand Morel's eyebrows rose slightly, and he sipped his drink.
I can see how I could be asked to get involved with the hunt for this man, as my people are all over the world and very well connected. But what I do not understand at all is why I am being asked to do this by you. What is your involvement?
Laska looked out at the bay.
I am a concerned citizen.
Bertrand Morel chuckled. His large frame shifted up and down in his chair as he did so.
I'm sorry, Paul. I need to know more than that to agree to this operation.
Now the Czech American turned his head to his guest.
All right, Fabrice. I am a concerned citizen who will see that your organization is paid whatever you wish to capture Mr. Clark and return him to the United States.
We can do this. Although I understand the CIA is working the same mission at present, I worry there is the potential for stepping on one another's toes.
The CIA does not want to catch the man. They will not get in the way of a motivated detective like yourself.
Are you doing this to help Edward Kielty?
The older man nodded as he sipped his cognac.
Now I see why President Kielty's people did not come to me about this.
The Frenchman nodded.
Am I to assume he has information that would be embarrassing to candidate Ryan?
The existence of John Clark is embarrassing to candidate Ryan. But without him captured, without the footage on the news of him being dragged into a police station, President Kielty looks impotent and the man remains a compelling mystery. We do not need him as a mystery. We need him as a prisoner, a criminal.
We, Paul?
I am speaking as an American and a lover of the rule of law.
Yes, of course you are, mon ami. I will begin work immediately on finding you, Mr. Clark. I assume you will be footing the bill, not the American taxpayer.
You will give me the figures personally, and I will have my foundation reimburse you. No invoice.
Pas de problème. Your credit is always good.
49. The wealth and connections of Jerry Henley came in handy at times like these. Across 400 meters of water from the Dubai safe house of Riaz Rian in Palm Jumeirah sat the five-star Kempinski Hotel and Residences, and here a three-bedroom water bungalow was owned by an English friend of Jerry's who worked in the oil and gas business. Henley told a man he needed to borrow his place, and the American financial manager offered an extraordinary sum for the property, paid out on a per-week basis. It would have been too perfect for the home to be empty at that moment. Instead, the friend of Jerry's was there with his wife and young daughter. But the oil and gas man was only too happy to pack up his family and move over to the opulent Burj Al Arab, an exquisite six-star hotel in the shape of a sail that jutted out into the Persian Gulf. All on Jerry Henley's dime, of course. The oil and gas man left his home just in time. The Gulfstream G550 landed at Dubai International Airport, cleared customs, and then parked in a great sea of corporate jets billeted at an FBO there on the ramp. As Ryan, Caruso, and Chavez began unloading their gear from the baggage compartment, Captain Reed and First Officer Hicks stood glassy-eyed on the hot tarmac. Not from exhaustion after the long flight, but in amazement at what they figured to be something in the neighborhood of $5 billion worth of machinery parked around them. Luxury jets and high-tech helicopters were lined up tip to tail, and Hicks and Reed both planned to get a closer look at each and every one. The three operators had plans themselves to get a closer look at one of the craft. A Bell Jet Ranger owned by the Kempinski was waiting to ferry them and their baggage directly to their residence. 20 minutes after deplaning from the Gulfstream, Dom, Ding, and Jack were back in the air, lifting into the glorious morning sunshine. They flew low along Dubai Creek at first, the wide waterway that separated old Dubai and its congested streets and low sprawling stone structures from the skyscrapers of New Dubai along the coast. Soon they headed out over the water, flying over the 5-kilometer-wide Palm Island itself, developed roads built up over the water in the shape of a tree trunk and 15 palm fronds, all these surrounded by a crescent-shaped island that served as a breakwater. On this breakwater sat the Kempinski Hotel and Residences, and here the helicopter landed. The three campus operators were led to their property, a luxurious bungalow alongside a placid lagoon. 400 yards away, Rian's safe house sat on the end of one of the palm fronds. They would be able to see it from here with the Leupold binoculars they brought with them, though they planned on getting a much closer look once night fell. At 2:30 in the morning, Ryan, Chavez, and Caruso sat in a rubber boat halfway between the Kempinski Hotel and residences and the palm frond upon which Rian's safe house sat, and they watched the dark compound through their night optics. They were happy to determine that, other than the small, permanent security force, a man at the front guardhouse and a couple of foot sentries on patrol, the grounds outside the main house seemed to be uninhabited. There would be cameras and motion detectors, and perhaps even acoustic monitoring equipment. But Chavez, Caruso, and Rian were prepared for this. So tonight, they would execute the most dangerous portion of their operation. They were much less concerned about equipment that could give them away, and much more concerned about men who could shoot them. They had rented the boat and the scuba gear from a paddy dive shop not far from their bungalow. All three men had significant scuba experience, though Domingo reminded them all that John Clark had more dives under his belt in 1 6-month period as a SEAL than Chavez, Rian, and Caruso had in their combined lives. Still, the water was calm, and they were not planning on going very deep or staying under very long. The small rubber boat was not optimal for the operation. Neither was the scuba equipment they wore. But this was the equipment available to them, so when Rian complained that their gear could be better, Chavez just reminded him that they would all have to adapt and overcome. If they had needed to make a true covert underwater entry on the compound itself, they would have preferred to use rebreathing equipment, regulators that did not emit bubbles, but instead reprocess the exhaled gas with fresh oxygen. Rebreathers were crucial for covert scuba work, but even though the basic open-circuit gear they had rented from the recreational dive shop would give off bubbles galore when they swam underwater, they did not plan on arriving close enough to the compound to attract attention before coming out of the water. They dropped anchor and slipped into the water silently. Rian handed weighted and watertight boxes over the side to the other two men before he climbed out of the rubber boat and attached his swim fins to his feet. Soon, all three men, each with a box in his hand, swam down to a depth of 10 feet and checked their dive computers, found the direction to their target, and lined their bodies up on the lubber line of their compasses. They headed out with Chavez in the lead. Rian brought up the rear. His pounding heart created an odd techno-style cadence when coupled with the hissing noise of his breathing through his regulator's valve. The warm black water cocooned him as he progressed, giving him the sense of being totally alone. Only the slight rhythmic pressures of his cousin Dominic's swim fins kicking 10 feet or so ahead of him reminded him that his colleagues were with him, and he was comforted by this knowledge. Finally, after he was underwater for 10 minutes, Jack's forehead bumped gently into Dominic's tank. Dom and Ding had stopped. They were on a sandy terrace on the incline that led out of the water up to the narrow strip of beach by Al-Kassab Road. The depth on the terrace was just 8 feet, and here Chavez used a faint red flashlight to show the other two where they should deposit their scuba gear. The men took off their equipment, strapped it together, and lashed it to a large rock, and then they each took one more long breath on their regulators. This done, the three men walked out of the water, dressed head to toe in black neoprene and carrying the watertight boxes with them. 10 minutes after leaving the ocean behind, Dom, Ding, and Jack had moved onto a darkened property 4 lots down from Rian's estate. This home was neither walled nor patrolled, so they took a chance there were no motion detectors installed either. Behind a large pool house, the Americans began setting up the equipment they'd pulled from the watertight cases. It took a good 15 minutes of preparations, each man working on his own project. But shortly after 3 a.m., Chavez gave a silent thumbs up, and Rian sat down with his back to the pool house wall. He placed a set of video glasses over his eyes, and he lifted a shoebox-sized remote control module out of a box. From now until the deployment of the surveillance equipment was complete, Jack Rian Jr. was in charge of this mission. With a well-practiced flick of a switch on the controller in his hands, Ryan's glasses projected the image transmitted from the infrared camera hanging from a rotating turret on the bottom of a miniature radio-controlled helicopter that sat on a fold-out plastic landing pad a few feet away. The over-under propellers of the tiny aircraft were only 14 inches in diameter, and the device looked not much different from a high-end toy. But this was no toy, as evidenced by the sound it made when Jack engaged the engine. Its motor generated only 30% of the noise of a regular RC helo of this size, and the device also carried a payload from an operator-releasable locking mechanism on its belly. The German company that manufactured the micro-helo sold it as a remote viewing and transporting device for the nuclear and biological waste industries, giving an operator standoff capability to view unsafe areas and deliver remote cameras and testing equipment. As the campus had moved from an assassination team to more of an intelligence gathering shop in the past year, they had been on the lookout for new technologies that could serve as force multipliers in their endeavors. They had only 5 field operators, after all, so they did what they could to leverage their efforts with high-tech solutions. Jack had a total of 5 payloads to deploy tonight with his microhelo, so he did not waste a moment before lifting his aircraft into the night sky. When Ryan had his tiny craft hovering 50 feet above its landing pad, his deft fingers moved to a toggle switch on the right side of his controller. Using this, he tilted down the camera on the turret below the nose, and with 90 degrees of tilt, he was looking down on himself and his 2 colleagues, tucked tightly into the darkest portion of yard behind the pool house. He then called out softly to Dom,
"Set waypoint Alpha."
Caruso sat next to him with a laptop computer opened and displaying the transmission from the tiny chopper's camera. With a click of a button, Dom created a waypoint in the memory of the microhelo, so that when called back to Alpha, the craft's GPS and autopilot would fly it directly back to a position over its base. After tapping the requisite keys of his computer, Dom said,
"Alpha set."
Jack then climbed the aircraft to a height of 200 feet. Once this altitude was attained, he flew over the 3 properties between his location and Rian's estate, flying with a slightly downward tilt to the turret cam so that he could monitor the sky in front of him as well. When he had positioned his helo and his payload directly over the flat portion of the roof of the estate, he called out to Dom,
"Set Bravo."
A moment later, the reply,
"Waypoint Bravo set."
Jack's target was the large air conditioning vent on the roof of the building, but he did not descend immediately. Instead, he used the turret cam, switched to thermal infrared, and began looking for Rian's guard force. He had no great worry about the device being seen in the darkness above the roof, but he was instead concerned about noise. Because although the microhelo's engine was indeed quiet, it was definitely not silent, especially when operating over a darkened property on a dead-end street in the middle of the night. Rian needed to make absolutely certain there were no guards on the roof or patrolling alongside the gardens at the northeastern part of the building. There were some other limitations to the technology as well, which Jack had to keep in mind, for the device's light weight made it susceptible to sea breezes coming in from the Gulf. Even with a stability control internal gyroscope, Jack had to take care that a breeze that pulled him off course did not disorient him and send him into a wall or a palm tree. He could combat this by trying to gain altitude or calling for Dom to send the helo back up to Waypoint Bravo, but he knew he would not have much time to make that decision once he got down closer to the ground. He scanned slowly. With his video glasses, all he saw through his own eyes was what was picked up by the tiny camera 200 feet over the ground and 150 yards away. Both he and Dom were involved in what they were doing, so it was Chavez's job to serve as team security. He had no laptop to monitor, no goggles obstructing his vision. Instead, he knelt by the pool house, using the infrared scope on his suppressed HK-MP7 submachine gun, scanning for threats. Through his goggles, Jack made out the heat register of the man at the front gate, and a second man, standing outside the guardhouse, chatting with him. Scanning back to the building, he found a third signature, a sentry strolling lazily all the way over by the tennis court helicopter pad. Ryan determined all 3 to be well out of earshot of his microhelo. He finally allowed himself a second to wipe a thick sheen of sweat from his brow before it dripped into his eyes. Everything, their entire mission, their biggest chance to obtain actionable intelligence on General Riaz Rihan depended on his fingertips and his decision-making in the next few minutes.
"I'm going in," he said softly,
and he gently touched the Y-axis joystick on the controller, bringing his buzzing craft down to 150 feet, then 100 feet, then 50 feet.
"Set waypoint, Charlie," he whispered. "Charlie set."
Quickly, he panned the camera back to the front guardhouse, then back to the helipad. He saw the 3 perimeter guards. They were right where they needed to be for him to continue on with his mission. He scanned the roof again, and it was clear. A breeze from the ocean sent his craft rocking to the left. He combated the motion with a counter motion on the X-axis joystick of the controller. Jack did not feel the breeze on his body by the pool house, but at 50 feet, it had come very close to sending his helo tumbling off course. He had a backup microhelo in one of the watertight cases, but setting it up for use would waste precious time. They had decided that if they lost a helo on the insertion, they would use the second craft to attempt to recover the first, as they did not want to leave a radio-controlled helicopter with a high-tech camera and a transmitter on the grounds of their target, lest the security force there be tipped off to the surveillance mission against them. Caruso leaned into his cousin's ear.
It's okay, Jack. Just try again. Take your time.
More sweat dripped into Ryan's eyes now. This wasn't like back on the roof or in the parking lot of Henley Associates. This was the field, the real world, and it bore no resemblance to his training. Jack let the sweat drip freely now as he concentrated on landing his remote aircraft. He touched down gently next to an air conditioning vent on the roof. Immediately, he shut down the helo, then put down the controller and lifted a second controller from the grass, finding it only by feeling around for a moment with his hands. This device was a one-handed module, not one-third the size of the remote control for the micro-helo. On this second handheld unit, he pushed a single button, and now his video glasses projected a new image over his eyes. It was a low-light camera image that showed one of the struts over the micro-helo's landing skids, and behind it, the narrow slats of the ventilation shaft. This second camera was fixed to a 4-inch-long, 2-inch-wide, 1-inch-tall robot that had been attached to the bottom of the helo by a magnet. On command from Ryan's controller, it released its magnetic hold, and when Ryan powered it up, two rows of tiny legs extended like a centipede, and it lifted off the roof. The legs were the propulsion system of this ground-traveling bugbot, and Ryan tested the device by ordering it forward and backward, then panning the 1080p video camera in all directions. Once satisfied that the robot was working nominally, he powered it down, then switched back to the helo controller. He ordered the micro-helo to hit its 3 waypoints and return to its helipad. 5 minutes later, he was flying a second bugbot to Rian's roof, landing it near the first. The wind had picked up a little between flights, so the second sortie took almost twice as long as the first.
"Ready for number 3, Jack whispered when the helicopter was back on its pad.
Chavez loaded the bugbot on the aircraft.
"Micro-helo is ready to launch payload 3.
"How are we on time, Ding?"
Ryan asked. After a moment's hesitation, Chavez said,
"Fair. Don't rush, but don't fuck around either."
"Roger that," Jack said,
and he switched his video glasses back over to the camera in the swivel turret under the micro-helo's nose. After the 3rd and 4th bugbots were delivered to the air vent over the attic of the target building, Jack brought the helo back to Waypoint Alpha, 200 feet above his head, in preparation for a landing. Chavez was ready with the 5th payload and fresh battery for the chopper, as they had determined it could not fly for more than an hour on a single charge.
"Okay," Jack said. "I'm bringing it down."
Just then, a breeze caught the helicopter, pushing it inland. Jack had dealt with a half a dozen such incidents in the past 45 minutes, so he did not panic. Instead, he brought the chopper back out over the water. It took a second for it to right itself, and he thought he had control. But it drifted again, and then a third time as he started his descent.
"Damn it," he whispered. "I think I'm losing her."
Caruso was watching the feed in his monitor.
"Just bring her down a little faster."
"Okay," Jack said. At 150 feet, the craft jolted forward, and Ryan had to pull it back.
"I'm losing the GPS hold. Could be losing battery."
Caruso said, "Ding, can you see it?"
Chavez looked into the night sky above.
"Negative." "Keep looking, you may have to catch it."
But it was too late. Jack saw his video feed turn away from the water and the lights of the Kempinski Hotel as the micro-helo began to spin slowly, and its descent speed increased sharply.
"Shit,"
he said a little too loudly, considering their covert position.
"It's dead. It's dropping."
"I don't see shit,"
Chavez said. He was walking around with his eyes in the sky.
"How fast is it coming down?"
Just then, the helicopter slammed into the grass 10 feet from its launch pad. It exploded into a dozen fragments. Jack took off his goggles.
"Son of a bitch."
Set up the reserve helo. But Chavez was already moving toward the wreckage.
"Negative. We'll go with the 4 bots we have in place. That's going to have to do it. We don't have time to send another bird up."
"Roger that," said Jack, secretly relieved. He was exhausted with the stress of flying the tiny aircraft into the target location, and he looked forward to getting back across the water, where Caruso would be in charge of operating the bug bots in the air vents. 50. It was approaching 5 a.m. when the 3 men got back to their bungalow. Jack was beyond exhausted. While Domingo and Dominic set up the remote equipment for the bugbots, Ryan dropped onto the couch, still wet from his swim. Dom laughed. He'd been through every bit of the physical exertion that his cousin had endured, but the mental strain of launching, flying, and landing had all been on Jack Jr. Now it was Caruso's turn to drive. Dominic had studied the architectural plans from the developers of several of the Palm Jumeirah properties in order to find the best entry points for their bug bots. The attic vents were deemed the best bet, and as the former FBI agent drove his first little bug-shaped robot into the vent, he was happy to find no post-construction metal grating or wire mesh in his way. The tiny legs on the robot could be magnetized for moving up and down metal surfaces, just like in the ductwork of the air conditioning system, so he had no problem moving on both the X and Y axes as he progressed deeper into Rion's safe house. The video quality was amazingly good, though the fluctuating transmission speeds at times caused a degradation in the quality. Dom and the other operators at the campus had also tested a thermal infrared camera, similar to but superior to the one in the nose turret of the Microhelos thermal cam. But ultimately, they decided that that feature would not be necessary for the indoor work they had planned here in Dubai. Plus, the infrared cams drew more battery power, and this would be detrimental to their mission, so they were not attached to the ground drones. After 20 minutes of operation, he had his first bot in position at the ground AC return duct in the master bedroom. Dom adjusted the tilt of the camera and checked to make certain that nothing was obstructing the pan. Then he set the white balance and focused. The laptop in the bungalow displayed a near-perfect color image of the room, and even though there was nothing to hear at the moment, the rush of air through the vent convinced him the audio was working nominally. Dominic Caruso repeated this process twice more over the course of the next hour. The second bug bot he placed in a duct overlooking the great room. The camera afforded only a narrow view of the sofa area and the entry hall, by no means a perfect shot of every corner of the room, but Caruso felt sure the microphone was positioned well to record anything that was said in the room below. The third bug bot started normally and moved a few inches, but stopped within a foot of the entrance to the ventilation system. Dom and Jack spent a few minutes troubleshooting the problem, but finally they gave up, unable to tell if there was some hardware damage to the transmitter or if a software glitch was creating the problem. They declared the device dead, and Caruso moved on to the last robot. This one he placed in a second-floor office area without any problems. By 7 a.m., the operation was complete, and Dominic powered down all the cameras. The surveillance equipment, the cameras, and the microphones were passive systems, meaning they did not operate all the time. Instead, they had to be turned on remotely. This saved battery power greatly, but it would also be incredibly beneficial for an operation that was expected to last a week or more. Caruso called Granger in Maryland, and Granger confirmed that they had been able to pick up feeds from three of the cameras and audio from three of the mics, just as Dom, Jack, and Dean could from the bungalow. The feed needed to be sent to the campus instantly, as it was assumed much of the audio they would pick up would be in Rion's native tongue, and Rick Bell had an Urdu-speaking analyst at the ready, 24/7. Caruso asked Granger if there was any news about Clark, but John had not checked in. Sam Granger also said that Sam Driscoll had not checked back in yet either, but they had no reason to suspect anything was amiss. When Chavez hung up with Granger, he flopped on the couch next to Ryan. Both men were worn out. At first, Jack Jr. was dejected with the success of the mission. "All that work and just 3 out of 5 cams and mics are online? Are you serious? For all we know, Rion likes to sit at the kitchen table when he works. If that's the case, we're fucked, because we won't hear a damn thing that isn't in the office, the great room, or the master bedroom." But Domingo calmed his junior colleague. "Don't ever forget, Mono. The real world isn't like the movies. As far as I'm concerned, 3 out of 5 is a home run. We are in. Doesn't matter if it's 1 camera or 100 cameras. We are fucking in. We'll get the goods, trust me." Chavez insisted the other two celebrate with him by ordering a massive breakfast. Ryan begged off at first, said he needed to catch some sleep. But once the Moët champagne, huge omelets, and flaky pastries arrived, Ryan got his second wind and he indulged with the other two. After breakfast, they cleaned their scuba gear. And then they slept. 51. It took Clark several days to locate his target in Germany. The man he sought was Manfred Krumm, and Krumm had proven to be an exceedingly challenging person to find. He was not undercover, nor was he taking active measures to ensure he remained hidden. No, Manfred Krumm was difficult to locate because he was a nobody. 30 years ago, he had played a role in East German intelligence. He and his partner had done something illegal, and Clark had been brought in to sort it out. Now the man was in his 70s, and he was no longer in Berlin, no longer a government employee, and no longer someone who anyone cared about. Clark knew he was still alive, because the questions the FBI asked Hardesty could have been triggered only by Manfred Krumm, Yes, it was possible Crom could have written down his version of events years ago and passed away in the interim, but Clark did not suppose that was a document Crom would have written willingly, and he did not suppose there was any reason that information should come to light right now, unless Crom had only recently told his story. Crom now lived in Cologne, Germany, in the state of North Rhine-Westphalia on the Rhine River. Clark had found his man finally after going to his last known address, a two-story building in the Hasselhorst section of Berlin, and then pretending to be a long-lost relative. A woman there knew Crom had moved to Cologne, and she knew he wore a brace on his leg due to nerve damage from his diabetes. Clark took this information and headed to Cologne, where he spent three full and very long days posing as an employee of a medical equipment company from the United States. He printed up business cards and invoices and phony email exchanges, and he took them to nearly every end-user supplier of medical devices in town. He claimed to have a customized ankle and foot orthotic ordered by a man named Crom, and requested help finding the man's current address. Some shops turned him away with a shrug, but most efficiently checked their databases, and one had a listing for a man named Manfred Crom, age 74, address Tiborgasse 13, flat 3A, who was sent monthly supplies of insulin test strips and syringes. And just like that, John Clark had found his man. Clark found the home of his target in the Altstadt of Cologne. Number 13 Tiborgasse was a four-story white stucco apartment building that was a carbon copy of the 50 or more that ran down both sides of the road, accented here and there with a single tree out front. The near-identical properties had tiny grass lawns bisected by 15-foot walkways up to the single glass doors to their lobbies. For an hour, John strolled the neighborhood in an afternoon rain shower that allowed him to use an umbrella and wear the collar of his raincoat high above his ears, and thereby mask his face. He determined possible escape routes in case his meeting did not go well, found his way to the bus stop and to the Straßenbahn, and from the streetcar, he kept an eye out for cops or postmen or any others who could be a bother if they passed up the street at the wrong time. These were rental buildings, and there was enough foot traffic in and out of them that he did not worry about drawing attention from passers-by. And after the hour of peripheral surveillance, he focused his attention on building number 13. The building was not old in the European sense. Very little in Cologne could be considered old, as the city had been altogether flattened during the Second World War. Spending several minutes across the street staring at number 13 Tiborgasse through the rainfall, Clark found the building to be as featureless and colorless and charmless as the Cold War itself. Back then, during a Cold War that was never cold enough for men on the sharp edge like John Clark, Clark had come to Germany on a special operation. He was CIA SAD at the time, the Special Activities Division. He was pulled out of a training evolution in North Carolina with members of the Army's newly minted Tier 1 unit, Delta Force, and he was put on a CIA 35A Learjet and flown to Europe. After a stop at Mildenhall AFB in Suffolk, England to refuel, Clark was back in the air. No one told him where they were taking him or what he'd be doing when he got there. Clark landed at Tempelhof in Berlin and was whisked to a safe house within pistol shot of the Berlin Wall. There, he met an old friend named Jean Lilly. They'd worked together in Nam, and now Lilly was the chief of CIA's Berlin station. Lilly told Clark he was needed for a simple bag drop operation over the border. But Clark smelled the bullshit in the story. He knew they didn't need an SAD hard asset for a bag drop. He relayed his doubt to his superior, and then Jean Lilly broke down in tears. Jean said he'd been caught in a honey trap by a hooker working with a couple of Stasi foot soldiers who'd gone rogue to make some extra cash. They had extorted from him all of his life savings, and he needed John to hand over the satchel full of cash and pick up a folder full of negatives. Clark did not ask what was on the negatives. He was damn certain he did not want to know. Lilly made it clear to Clark that there was no one else in the agency he trusted, and the 33-year-old SAD asset agreed to help out his old friend. Minutes later, John was handed a satchel full of Deutschmarks and taken to the U-Bahn. Then he shuffled into a train half full of locals. The exchange between Clark and the Stasi extorters was to be in a surreal location, unique to Berlin and the Cold War. The West German subway system had a few underground rail lines that, rather inconveniently, ventured under East Berlin. Before the partition of the city, this was of no consequence. But after the Berlin Wall was erected in 1961, the lines that rolled under the wall were no longer allowed to stop at the stations on the other side. The East Germans boarded or barred the doors at street level. In some cases, they even built apartment complexes over their access, and they wiped any references to the subway stations from East German rail maps. Down below, these dark, vacant, and labyrinthine halls became known as Geisterbahnhof, ghost stations. A few minutes past midnight, John Clark dropped out of the back of the last car of the U-8 train that rolled under the Mitte district of East Berlin. As the train clicked and clacked its way up the tunnel, the American pulled out a flashlight, adjusted the satchel over his shoulder, and walked on. In minutes, he'd found his way to the Weinmeisterstrasse U-Bahn ghost station. And here he waited on the darkened concrete platform, listening to the sound of rats below him and bats above him. Within minutes, a flashlight's beam appeared in a stairwell. A single man appeared behind it, shined his light on Clark, and told him to open the satchel. Clark did as he was told, and then the man lowered a package to the dusty concrete and slid it over to the American. Clark picked up the package, checked it to make certain they were the negatives, and then he left the satchel. It could have, it should have, ended right there. But the Stasi crooks were greedy, and they wanted their negatives back for another round of blackmail. John Clark turned and began heading toward the edge of the platform, but he heard a noise on the opposite platform across the rails. He shined his light over there in time to see a man with a handgun leveled at him. Clark dove and rolled onto the filthy concrete floor as a pistol shot cracked and echoed around the maze of tunnels and open halls. The American CIA officer came out of his role onto his feet with a Colt 45 caliber 1911 model pistol in his hands. He fired twice across the tracks, hit the shooter both times in the chest, and the man dropped where he stood. Clark then shifted to the man with the money satchel. The Stasi agent had retreated back up the stairwell. Clark took a shot but missed low just before the man disappeared from view. He considered going after the man. It was the natural tendency of a direct action expert like Clark, as he could not be certain the surviving Stasi man would not turn the tables and come after him. But just then, the next train through the ghost station approached, and Clark was forced to quickly duck behind a concrete column. The bright lights of the train cast long shadows on the dusty platform. Clark slid to the tiled floor and chanced to look toward where the East German had disappeared. He saw nothing in the moving lights, and he knew that if he missed this train, he'd have to wait here another 10 minutes for the next one. Clark timed his leap onto the rear car perfectly. He caught onto a handhold by the back door and then moved around behind the car. He rode back there through the dark for several minutes, until he was in West Berlin, where he melted into the light station traffic. 30 minutes later, he was on a streetcar full of West Germans heading home after working the night shift, and 30 minutes after that, he was handing the negatives off to Jean Lilly. He flew out of Germany on a commercial flight the next day, certain that nothing that had happened would ever go into the archives of the CIA or the East German Statische Geheimdienst. Standing there in the cold rain in Cologne, he shook off the memory and looked around. The Germany of today bore little resemblance to the divided nation of 30 years ago, and Clark reminded himself that today's problems needed his undivided attention. At 4 p.m., the day's light was leaving the gray sky, and a light came on in the tiny lobby of number 13 Thieboldgasse. Inside, he could see an elderly woman leashing her dog at the foot of a stairwell. Quickly, Clark crossed the street, hitched his collar higher up around his neck, and arrived at the side of the building just as the woman exited the front door, her eyes already on the street ahead. As the door closed behind her, John Clark moved up the wall through the grass and stepped in silently. He was already halfway up the staircase with his Sig Sauer pistol in his hand by the time the door latch clicked behind him. Manfred Krohm reacted to the knock at his door with a groan. He knew it would be Hertha from across the hall. He knew she would have locked herself out yet again while walking that little gray bitch poodle of hers, and he knew he would have to pick her lock like he'd done dozens of times before. He'd never told her where he learned to pick locks, nor had she asked. That she locked herself out purposely so that he would pay attention to her only annoyed him further. He could not be bothered with the old woman. She was a pest of the highest order, only slightly less annoying than her yapping Hundchen Fifi. Still, Manfred Krohm did not let on that he knew her weekly lockouts were a ruse. He was a loner and a social hermit. He would no more insinuate to people that they were interested in him than he would sprout wings and fly. So he smiled outwardly, groaned inwardly, and unlocked the old bitch's gottverdammt door each time she knocked. He climbed up from his chair, shuffled to the door, and lifted his picks off of the table in the entryway of his flat. The aged German put his hand on his door latch to step into the hall. Only the old force of habit made him look through the peephole. He went through the motions of glancing into the hallway, had begun to remove his eye after looking so he could open the door, but then his eye widened in surprise and it rushed back to the tiny lens in the door. There, on the other side, he saw a man in a raincoat. And in the man's hand, a stainless steel automatic pistol with a suppressor attached was pointed directly at Manfred Krohm's door. The man spoke in English, loud enough to be heard through the woodwork.
"Unless your door is ballistic steel or you can move faster than a bullet, you'd better let me in."
"Wer ist denn da?"
"Who the hell is it?" Krohm croaked. He spoke English. He'd understood the man with the gun, but he had not used the language himself in many years. The right words would not pass his lips.
"Someone from your past."
And then Krohm knew. He knew exactly who this man was. And he knew he was about to die. He opened the door.
"I know your face. It's older, but I remember you," Krohm said.
As instructed by Clark, he had moved to his chair in front of the television. His hands were on his knees, kneading the swollen joints slowly. Clark stood above him, his weapon still pointing at the German.
"Are you alone?"
Clark asked the question but searched the tiny flat without waiting for a response. Manfred Krohm nodded.
"Selbstverständlich."
"Of course." Clark kept looking around, keeping the SIG pointed at the old man's chest. He said,
"Keep perfectly still. I've had a lot of coffee today. You don't want to see how jumpy I am."
"I will not move," the old German said.
Then he shrugged.
"That gun in your hand is the only weapon in this flat."
Clark checked over the rest of the tiny apartment. It did not take long. It could not have been 400 square feet, including the bathroom and the kitchen. He found a door to a fire escape in the kitchen, but nothing whatsoever as far as luxuries.
"What, 35 years in the Stasi and this is all you get?"
Now the German in the chair smiled a little.
"From the comments of your government regarding you, Herr Clark, it does not look like your organization has rewarded your efforts much more than my organization has rewarded mine."
Clark cracked a sour grin himself as he used his legs to push a small table flush against the front door. It might slow someone coming in from the hall for a moment, but not much more than that. Clark stood next to the door, kept the SIG trained on the burly man sitting uncomfortably on the recliner.
"You have been telling tales."
"I have said nothing."
"I don't believe you, and that is a problem."
Clark kept his weapon trained as he moved sideways along the front wall of the room into the corner. On the adjoining wall sat a tall antique china cabinet. He pushed it toward the open doorway to the tiny kitchen in order to block the entrance to the flat from the rear fire escape. Inside, dishes rocked and a few tipped over as the big wooden piece came to rest, covering the doorway. Now the only entrance to the room was the bedroom behind Manfred.
"Tell me what you told them. Everything."
"Mr. Clark, I have no idea what you..."
30 years ago, three people went into the Geisterbahnhof. Two of those people came out alive. You were working for the Stasi, as was your partner, but you two fellows were not playing by Stasi rules, which means you extorted that money for yourself. I was ordered to let you two walk away, but your partner, Lucas Schumann, tried to kill me after you got the money. I killed Lucas Schumann, and you got away. And I know you did not run back to Marcus Wolf and tell him about how your illegal moonlighting job turned ugly. You would have kept your mouth shut to everyone so you didn't have to turn over the cash."
Krohm did not speak, but only squeezed his hands into his knees as if he were kneading fat brötchen before putting them in the oven. Clark said,
"And I was under orders to keep the affair out of the official record of my agency. The only person other than you, me, and poor dead Lucas Schumann who knew about what happened in the ghost station that night was my superior, and he died 15 years ago without breathing a word of it to anyone."
"I don't have the money anymore. I spent it," Krohm said.
Clark sighed as if disappointed with the German's comment.
"Right, Manfred. I came back 30 years later to retrieve a messenger bag full of worthless Deutschmarks."
"Then what do you want?"
"I want to know who you talked to."
Krohm nodded. He said,
"I think this is an American movie cliche, but it is the truth. If I tell you, they will kill me."
"Who, Manfred?"
"I did not go to them. They came to me. I had no interest in digging up the buried bones of our mutual past."
Clark lifted the pistol and looked down its tritium sights.
"Who, Manfred? Who did you tell about 81?
"Obchak,"
Manfred blurted it out in panic. Clark's head cocked to the side. He lowered the weapon.
"Who is Obchak?"
"Obchak is not a who, it's a what. It's an Estonian criminal organization. A foreign office of the Russian mob, so to speak.
John did not hide his confusion.
And they asked you about me? By name?
Nein, they weren't asking in the regular sense. They hit me. They broke a bottle of beer, put the broken bottle up to my throat, and then they asked me.
And you told them about Berlin?
Natürlich. Of course. Kill me for it if you must, but why should I protect you?
Something occurred to Clark. How did you know they were Optschak?
Krom shrugged.
They were Estonian. They spoke Estonian. If someone is a thug and they are Estonian, then I presume them to be an Optschak.
And they came here?
To my house? Nein. They had me meet them at a warehouse in Deutz. They told me there was money for me, security work.
Security work? Don't bullshit me, Krom. No one is going to hire you to do security work.
The German's hands rose quickly as he began to argue, but the barrel of Clark's SIG was trained again on Krom's chest in the space of a heartbeat. Krom lowered his hands.
I have done some work for members of the Eastern European immigrant community in the past.
What, like forgery?
Krom shook his head. He was too proud to keep quiet.
Locks. Lock picking.
Cars?
Now the old German smiled.
Gas? No.
Car lots. Dealerships. It helps to add to my tiny pension. Anyway, I knew some Estonians. I knew the man who asked me to go to the warehouse, otherwise I would never have agreed to go.
Clark reached into the pocket of his raincoat, pulled out a notepad and a pen, and tossed it to the old man.
I want his name, his address, any other names you know. Estonians working in Optschak.
Krom deflated in his chair.
They will kill me.
Leave. Leave right now. Trust me. Whoever questioned you about me is long gone. That's who I'm after. The men who set it up are just the local thugs. Get out of Cologne and they won't pester you.
Krom did not move. He only looked up at Clark.
I will kill you, right here, right now, if you do not do as I say.
Krom slowly began to write, but then he looked up past the gun barrel, as if he had something to say.
Write or talk, Clark said. But do it now, or I put a bullet in one of those sore knees of yours.
The German pensioner said, After they took me, I spent a day in the hospital. I told his doctor I was mugged, and then I came home, angry and determined to retaliate against the men. The leader, the man who asked the questions, he was not a local. I could tell this because he spoke no German, only Estonian and Russian.
Keep talking.
I have a friend still in Moscow. He knows his way around.
Around the mafia, you mean?
Krom shrugged. He is an entrepreneur. Anyway, I called him up and asked him for information on Optschak. I did not tell him the real reason. I am certain he assumed I had business. I described the man who interrogated me. 50 years old, but with hair dyed like he was a 20-year-old singer in a punk rock band.
And your friend gave you a name?
He did.
And what did you do?
Krom shrugged. He looked at the floor in humiliation.
What could I do?
I was drunk when I thought I could get revenge. I sobered up.
Give me the man's name.
If I do that, if I tell you about a man in Tallinn who came here and ordered the others to beat me, will you bypass the men here in Cologne? Maybe if you go directly to Tallinn, they will not know that I informed.
That suits me just fine, Manfred.
Sehr gut, said Krom,
and he gave Clark a name as the last of the afternoon's light left the sky outside. 52. Unlike the government agencies searching for international fugitive John Clark, Fabrice Bertrand Morel investigations billed by the man hour, so they used a lot of men, working a lot of hours. And it was only this intense canvassing of choke points across Europe that helped them locate their quarry. Bertrand Morel had concentrated his hunt in Europe because Alden had, through Laska, passed the Frenchman a copy of the dossier on the ex-CIA man. FBM decided Clark's recent work in Europe with NATO's Rainbow Organization would mean he would have sympathetic contacts on the continent. So a single FBM man had been placed in each of 64 train stations across Europe, working 14-hour shifts, passing out flyers, and showing photos of Clark to station employees. They had turned up nothing in days of waiting and watching. But finally, a man working a pretzel stand at the Cologne Hauptbahnhof had caught a glimpse of a figure in a crowd passing by. He looked at the photo on the small card he'd been handed 3 days earlier by a bald Frenchman, and then he quickly dialed the number on the back of the card. The Frenchman had offered him a large reward, paid in cash. 20 minutes later, the first FBM man arrived at the Cologne Hauptbahnhof to interview the pretzel salesman. The middle-aged man was clear-headed and convincing. He was certain John Clark had passed him heading for the front entrance of the Hauptbahnhof. Soon, three more FBM men, the entire force within an hour's drive, were in the station working on a plan of action. They had little to go on save for the report that their man had entered the city. They could not very well just spread out, sending four men out into the fourth largest metropolis in Germany. So they left a man at the station while the other three checked the nearby hotels and guest houses. It was the agent at the station who got the hit. Just after 9 on the cold and rainy evening, 40-year-old Lyonnais private detective and employee of Fabrice Bertrand Morel Investigations, Luc Paton, stood just at the entrance smoking a cigarette, his eyes occasionally drifting up to the incredible Cologne Cathedral just to the left of the train station, but his main focus remained on the foot traffic that streamed past him toward the tracks behind. There, in a large group of pedestrians, a man who bore a reasonable resemblance to his target shuffled by with the collar of his raincoat up high. Luc Paton said softly, "Bonsoir, mon ami." He reached into his pocket and retrieved his mobile phone. Domingo Chavez had set up a more low-tech monitoring operation for Riyadh Dubai's safe house than that of the two younger operators with their robot cameras and microphones. One of the three bedrooms in the bungalow looked out over the lagoon, into the waterway, between the crescent-shaped breakwater upon which the Kempinski sat and the palm frond-shaped peninsula where Riyadh's safe house was located. The distance between the two locations was easily 400 meters, but that was not too far away for Chavez to employ a toy he'd brought along on the flight in from the States. He set up the variable power Zeiss Victory FL spotting scope on its tripod, and he placed the tripod on a desk in the bedroom in front of the window. From his chair at the desk, he could see the very back of Riyadh's walled-in compound and several second-floor windows. The blinds had remained closed, as had the back gate, but he hoped that the property might open up a little bit when it was actually being lived in by Riyadh and an entourage from Islamabad. When he realized that he had a fair line of sight on the compound, he also got another idea. If Riyadh was truly as dangerous as their investigations were leading them to believe, might the campus not decide, sooner rather than later, to take him out? And if they did make the call for the operators to assassinate the general, would it not be much easier to do it right here, with a long-range rifle and good optics, as opposed to having to find some other opportunity to get close to the man, either here in Dubai or, God forbid, in Islamabad? Chavez determined he could make the shot on General Riyadh, if the man stepped out onto his second-floor balcony, or even appeared in an upper-floor window of the safe house, and he ran his thoughts by Ryan and Caruso. Both men supported the idea of being ready for a termination order from Henley and Granger, so Chavez called Sam Granger and asked to have some equipment flown in so that he would be ready in the event something during their surveillance led to the green light to drop Riyadh. The Gulfstream would be flying in the equipment in 2 days' time, which meant Ding would have a gun ready to make the shot well before he expected his potential target to arrive in the city. Clark saw the watcher just after 9 p.m. He had just finished his second dry cleaning run of the evening before returning to the station. He hadn't seen anyone following him at any point in his visit to Cologne, but when he stood in line at a kiosk to buy a couchette ticket to Berlin, a gentle sweep of his head in all directions revealed a single man watching him from 35 yards away. A second glance, several seconds later, confirmed it. He'd been spotted. John stepped out of line at the kiosk. This would be conspicuous, but a hell of a lot better than waiting around for the watcher's backup to arrive. He strolled through the station toward the northern exit, and seconds later, he realized that two new men had joined the hunt. They were on him before he was out of the station, and he knew it, because he'd been spotting tails since before these three goons were born. Two men with short beards and dark hair, the same approximate age, the same build, the same general style of raincoats. They were entering the station as he was exiting 2 minutes earlier, and now they were walking 30 yards behind and slightly to the right as John turned in front of the cathedral. A wet sleet fell on them all as Clark headed south. John did not get overly excited by having acquired a tail. He was not going to let a little surveillance shake him up. He could lose these men in the darkness and foot traffic of the city and then be on his way again in no time. He turned left at the southern edge of the cathedral and headed for the western bank of the Rhine River. After passing a section of road with worn stones laid by the Romans, he tried to catch a glimpse of the man behind him in the glass of the Dorant Hotel. The two men were there, together, not more than 25 yards back. He wondered if the third man was trying to get ahead of him now. Clark turned south, walked along Malgasa, full of restaurants with tables spilling away from building facades toward the river's edge, and with diners laughing and mingling with one another under heated canopies. He was as concerned about his status as an internationally sought criminal as he was afraid of the